Okay. Thanks very much, Peter, and thanks for inviting me to be a part of this symposium. It's a big topic to carry, to try and cover in 30 minutes, and one can run into all sorts of problems with the things one says, and probably more problems from the things one doesn't say. But to start with, let me just define what I and what we in CIMMYT mean by conservation agriculture, because there is some confusion on that. We believe it's a set of techniques and technologies that are covered by three principles. Keeping crop surface, crop residues on the soil surface, moving the soil as little as possible, and crop rotation. So within that, it's very difficult to get statistics on how much conservation agriculture there is in the world. But Rolf Dörpsch puts together these figures every now and then on the areas of no tillage. And a lot of this area does, in fact, keep crop residues on the surface. Not all of it, I think, has crop rotation. But you see there that they're talking about 106 million hectares worldwide of no-tillage agriculture or conservation agriculture. So it is now a sizable amount. Now, what are the effects of this amount of conservation agriculture on climate change? And some of we don't have that obviously quantified, but some of the effects that we're looking at, of course, is a reduction in fuel use and a reduction in CO2 emissions from fuel. And here, this is some data from the lowlands of Bolivia. Some years ago, a large company that kept very careful records of their fuel use over a period of change from conventional to conservation agriculture. And you see there an 80% reduction in fuel use per hectare. Now, FAO quotes 30 to 40%. In many situations, it appears to be higher. Peter, I think you and your group in India looked at about 70% reductions in fuel use. I'm picking up some examples from other places, some data I saw the other day from Illinois, about 30%. Kazakhstan, it's about 30 to 40%. And I think a lot of it just depends on what the status of what the conventional tillage is and how many passes of machinery people do in that conventional state. But we do see, obviously, therefore, quite major reductions in fuel use and emissions of CO2 from fuel burning. Now, conservation agriculture, obviously, one of the things we talk about is sequestering carbon in the soil. Bram Koverts did recently a review of a literature review and found that when he did this, about half the cases there was some increase in soil carbon. Nearly the other half there was very little or no difference, and in a few cases there was in fact a reduction. Of course, this begs the question of just what was the conservation agriculture, how was the system imposed that were being used in those cases where there wasn't any increase. And I'll touch on that a bit later. And of course, that's how it's actually put into practice, the conservation agriculture is a very important factor, and it leads to a lot of the queries about the system, the Giller paper that came out last year and so on. And because we're not talking about a technology per se, we're talking about principles, there's a lot of different ways that it can be applied, and whether it's being applied in the best possible way for a set of situations is, of course, open to question. Looking down at some of the other reviews of the effects of CA on carbon sequestration, this one by Western Post in 2002, they come up with a figure of about 570 kilograms of carbon per hectare per year, and six across a range of environments from tropical to temperate came up with a figure a little bit lower of 325. So in general, apart from the Koverts paper, people see an increase in soil carbon sequestration with CA. And of course, this is what we see when we till the soil, and this is some data from Don Rykowski, who's unfortunately talking just about now in another session, and of CO2 coming off a tilled field. And this is only in 19 days. And here you see, this one is the moldboard plow, and this is the no-till down at the end. And here's a range of vertical tillage systems in the middle. Here, this is a moldboard plow and two disc harrowings. And obviously a lot lower carbon emissions from the no-till than from the moldboard plow. What's interesting here is that this is the level of carbon that was incorporated into the soil from the wheat residues. And following the moldboard plow, in just 19 days, you've lost more carbon than all of the residues that were incorporated. So obviously, that leads to what we see in the decline in soil organic matter with tillage. Of course, burning of crop residues is another factor that we can stop when we move to conservation agriculture. Fairly common in irrigated areas, especially where they do have excessive amounts of residues, but one also sees it in a fair number of rain-fed areas where residues are not huge amounts, but farmers just like to get rid of them because it makes their life easier. But if we can obviously stop this, we decrease a lot of CO2 emissions and methane emissions as well. Now, I'm going back to this figure, this table here of Derpsch and Friedrich. I just want to make the point that most of the CA adoption is on large mechanized farms, and most of it is, in fact, in rain-fed areas. So if you look down here in the USA, Brazil, Argentina, Canada, Australia, Paraguay, and Kazakhstan, basically it's all, most of it, on large mechanized farms, and most of it in dry land or rain-fed areas. There is some areas under irrigated agriculture. Obviously, when it's sprinkler or overhead irrigated, it makes very little difference to the normal rain-fed systems. Where it's gravity irrigated, of course, one of the problems is how to maintain the water channels and be able to irrigate the system when you keep residues. However, Ken Say has done a lot of work on developing permanent bed systems, and now we do find that we can cover surface irrigated areas with conservation agriculture as well. But if we look at the expansion of the area of no-till, and just taking one example here of Brazil, we saw, and this repeats itself in just about all of the countries, you see a very rapid increase in the early 1990s, areas fairly slow over the 70s and the 80s, but when the patent came off Roundup, that was a major factor in enabling the spread of conservation agriculture. Weed control, when you stop tilling the soil, is a major factor, and so when the price of Roundup came down because the patent came off, that allowed the spread. Now, you'll see here that I've got the green lines are all the farms, and the brown ones are the small farms. You probably can't see the brown ones, but they're way down here, right? So most of the spread of conservation agriculture on large farms. We have to get it moving on small farms. But when we look at those little brown lines down the bottom, we see that more or less they follow the same sort of curve. It's just that the scale is different. And here in Brazil, we're getting up to, by 2002, which is the last data I have, about 170,000 hectares of smallholder no-till agriculture. Now, smallholder farmers commonly feel problems. They, I'm not sure what was Corinne that was mentioning, they don't feel that they don't talk about climate change, but they certainly see the problems of degradation and then what's happening to their land. And this is a case from Zimbabwe of a group discussion with farmers about their problems. And they talk about the crops drying off, the soil is sick, there's little water, they've got little information on fertilizer amounts, because this amount of fertilizer used to grow good maize, but now it doesn't. They have to apply more, and it's still poor. They get waterlogging, rapid soil driving, hard surface crust. So all of these have to do largely with soil degradation. And farmers are seeing it. They see the problems. Then they get into others, like weeds, and they need knowledge on herbicides, the problems of rats and mice and wild pigs and termites. But all of the top ones are to do with soil degradation. And I find this wherever I've worked, farmers are very attuned to the problems that they're seeing of soil degradation. Now, the benefits of CA, I was talking about the difference between small and large farmers. The benefits, of course, are the same for small and large farmers. A lot of different benefits, and a lot of them, especially in rain-fed agriculture, to do with water balance. You get increased water infiltration, reduced moisture evaporation, and of course, with the increased infiltration, less water runoff, and therefore less soil erosion. Reduction in labor and energy use, I'll comment on in a moment, very important. Less turnaround time between crops. This can be very important where you're able to get more than one crop a year. And for instance, in South Asia, this I think was probably one of the biggest drivers. Get greater biological activity in the soil. And then a series of factors that change slowly over time. You get an increase, a reduction in production costs, and this is basically as weed populations go down, and so the cost of controlling weeds comes down. You get increases in soil organic matter, I referred to this earlier, and therefore increases in nutrient availability, and of course with the increase in biological activity, greater possibilities of biological pest control. Now, the principles of conservation agriculture appear to have extremely wide applicability. We see functional CA systems from the equator up to 60 degrees north in Finland, from sea level to over 3,000 meters above sea level on soils, from 84% clay in Brazil to over 90% sand in Zimbabwe and Australia, on a wide range of crops, all of the cereals, soybeans, sunflower, even potatoes, cassava, and so on. So we see the system functioning under a very, very wide range of conditions. But of course, the actual formula and techniques and technologies for applying those principles are very site-specific. And not only site-specific to the biophysical conditions, but also to farmer circumstances. And you see on the bottom the photos here, obviously, very different ways of applying conservation agriculture, from the mechanized system on the left to an animal traction system or just a manual system on the right. So the way of putting those principles into effect is very different. And of course, the problems of applying it are also going to be very different. Now, when we conduct surveys of farmers who have adopted conservation agriculture, we find that smallholders and large farmers share many of the same perceptions, but how important those different factors are for them are different depending on the size of their holdings. So smallholders, the big factor that they find is the lower labor requirement, as well as the reduced drudgery. And they also, there are others down there that they can expand their planting area, they reduce the production costs, obviously. Those are the major drivers for them. For large farmers, of course, the drivers may be somewhat different. But I do want to point out that the benefits are common, but just the importance for different groups of farmers does vary. Now, labor use and labor productivity, as I just mentioned, is the major driver, it appears, in most cases where smallholders have taken on conservation agriculture. In many cases, the farmers, to them, the unit of production per day of labor is, in fact, more important than the unit of production per hectare. And of course, this is in sub-Saharan Africa where we see the scourge of HIV/AIDS. This is also very important, the reduction in labor requirements. Now, just down at the bottom, to give you an idea of of just how much labor and how much drudgery there is involved. Photo there of a farmer in Ethiopia, same data that we measured in Bolivia. To plow a land and plant a crop of wheat, which he will normally do two passes with the plow, broadcast the wheat, and then make another pass with the plow, he is walking behind his oxen for 100 kilometers for each hectare that he seeds. That is a lot of work. So you can see how important, when he sees a way that he can get away from that labor, he will take it up. This lady in Malawi, where they manage manual systems, 140,000 hoe strokes per hectare just to prepare the land and the ridges. If we can get away from doing that, that's a huge amount of work that we can save. So today there are a large number of smallholder farmers practicing CA. Not obviously as big the curve as we saw on the large holders, but we have examples in Brazil, Paraguay, China, Ghana, Zambia, and I have in parentheses there the Indo-Gangetic Plains, because the no-till seeding of wheat has progressed a lot, and we've got probably around 2 million hectares of no-till wheat in the region. But as Peter was asking about earlier, the direct seeding of rice and the no-till area of rice has lagged behind. Now, because of the problems of labor in South Asia and the shortages of labor, that is driving a lot of change, and I think now we're going to see a real spread of complete conservation agriculture systems in South Asia. So it's a very interesting and exciting period of change in South Asia at the moment. Now, there are a lot of characteristics here of small farmers. I'm not going to go through them all. Capital, knowledge systems, subsistence, and so on. But the one that I want to stress is their aversion to risk. Smallholder farmers are not able to support risk because their livelihoods, because their family food requirements depend on their farming. They cannot accept risk. They also are not often buffered against that risk by credit systems and loans and so on. So they're not able to accept that risk. And in that light, I want to talk a little bit about something that I think is going to probably come up tomorrow in the discussions on the Green Revolution in Africa. When we look at sub-Saharan Africa, people talk about the fact that the nutrients are the most limiting factor, and they probably, biophysically, nutrients are, I think, without any doubt, the most important factor limiting crop productivity in sub-Saharan Africa. Farmers in overall of the region use just over 10 kilos per hectare of nutrients, very, very low. But farmers know the benefits of those fertilizers. They use them on their other crops. They use them on the high-value cash crops. So it's not that they don't know about fertilizers. The cost of fertilizer is obviously an issue, and this is why when we get subsidies such as we're seeing in Malawi at the moment, there's a very large impact of those subsidies. But then the main factor that inhibits fertilizer use is risk, because if there's a percentage of years, and it doesn't have to be very high, when the farmer loses money by applying fertilizers, they are very wary of doing it, and they stop doing it very soon. Now, unfortunately, when we look at climate change, and we look at the factors that the previous speakers have talked about many of these factors, but we're going to see changes in temperature and precipitation, higher CO2, and so CO2 fertilization, that's a positive one, climate variability and soil water runoff, but most of those are going to increase risk. And that is one of the factors, it is the factor that has the most impact on small farmer production, agricultural production. Now, what can CA do about risk? Obviously here, this is some fairly common data that we see from many parts. There's in fact examples from Zambia and Zimbabwe where we see increased water infiltration. This is with a simulated rainfall of 95 millimeters, but you see this is the common tilled practice. The blue line at the bottom, the red and the green are two different options of conservation agriculture. So we get increased water infiltration. There's a small error here. This is the 2005-2006. This is, in fact, 2006-2007. So when we look at water, soil water over the season, this was a wet year and a dry year, we see that in these two CA practices, we've got consistently more water in the profile than we have with conventional agriculture. Obviously, this then is going to buffer the farmer against risk. And if we integrate that over the season, we've got about a 15 to 20% increase in soil moisture, available soil moisture, over the whole season. So obviously a big reduction in risk there. With the increase in infiltration, lower runoff, also reducing risk, because of course most of the seed and fertilizer that a farmer applies is in that topsoil that is very susceptible to erosion, and so that is what goes first. And of course we see here, this is in Zimbabwe, erosion over the season, about just over 14 tons per hectare. We get more than we would have expected here on the CA systems, but that's because we hand weed it. This is not, does not have chemical control, and we hoe weed, and with the hoe weeding, we do move the soil, and so we are getting some more erosion there. We've done some experiments with just chemical control, and we reduce this to down below 1 ton per hectare when we use chemical control of weeds. This is some data from Mexico. The green lines are no-till in a wheat maize system, and the red lines are conventional tillage. Now, there's two things I'd like to show you here. Have a look at the way the red lines go up and down compared to the green, the top green line, which is a lot more stable. That is the stability, the reduction in risk of losses in different seasons. The other thing is, of course, the importance of residues. And I think it was Peter that was talking about this problem of competition for residues. Here, this top one is zero till with residues kept. Same fertilizer, same variety. And here's the one in a dry year when you don't keep the residues and, of course, has a major effect on productivity. So residues are important, and we do have to look at how to overcome that competition, how much the farmer can take off. But in the end, the farmer has to see that it's worth more leaving it on his land than passing it through a cow before he's going to do it. Now, I'm going to show some results from some farmer-managed on-farm trials over five seasons in communities in Malawi. And I'm going to spend a little time on this first one just to show you what they are, and then I'm going to flick through a number of the others. We've got three treatments here, a conventionally tilled treatment, direct seeded maize, and this has here, it has both a desiccant, glyphosate applied at the beginning of the season, and a residual herbicide, and so is just a maize crop. This one here is direct seeded as well. It only has a glyphosate at the beginning of the season, and it does have an intercrop with a legume, but the yield of the intercrop is not included here. The red lines is the minimum yield over all of the trials we've had in the five seasons. The period varies a little bit between communities, but this particular one is five seasons. So the red line is the minimum, the green line, or the green bar, is the mean, and the yellow line is the maximum. Now, as scientists, we're probably most interested in the mean, and here we see that the two direct-seeded or CA treatments are, in fact, statistically greater yielding than the Czech. The economists, and actually agronomists, would tell you that this is, in fact, the most important here, the marginal rate of return. This treatment here with just the glyphosate is, in fact, our most economically viable treatment. Now, this has a marginal rate of return of 3.9. A minimum we'd normally accept as 1, so 3.9 is very, very good. But so for the small farmer, this is the factor that is most important to him. What is the yield in the worst year? How much is he going to lose in the worst year? So we think this, we use this, we think he should take this into account, but in fact, farmers tend to look at this line down here. So when we look at different communities, you can see that generally that red line is below in the conventional than it is in the other two treatments. The same trend follows on the green one, but you will see that the risk of loss is always much greater in with conventional agriculture. And then we get to some, this is a waterlogged site right on the edge of Lake Malawi. We haven't worked out how to do CA yet. Basically very little difference in risk. Here's another one where we're still struggling to adapt the system. Again, not there. And here, a little bit lower, but it's another one where we're still struggling to adapt the system. This is on very marked hillsides, and we have major problems with white grubs and a hard pan. So we haven't got the system right in all of the situations. But where we have got it right, we see a big reduction in risk, we see an increase in yield, and we see an increase in economic advantages. So in summary, what we can see is that CA mitigates global warming by reducing GHG emissions from fuel use, from straw burning, and possibly from carbon sequestration. I didn't mention nitrous oxide emissions. It's one that's a little bit worrying. Sarah was mentioning what happens in rice. In general, that sixth paper that I mentioned suggests that we get more nitrous oxide emissions from CA, and I think just as Sarah was suggesting, the problem is that we don't know how to manage it properly yet, and we've got to do a lot of research on how to manage nitrogen in CA situations. Conservation agriculture helps farmers to adapt to climate change, you know, with improved water balance and less erosion. It offers increased productivity of land, labor, and capital, helping smallholder farmers become more food secure. And it also offers reduced risk, especially in rain-fed areas and drier seasons. So with that, I'd like to finish off. Thank you very much.
We have time for a couple of questions. Any questions?
Yes, sir.
Very good questions. I think small farmers can handle glyphosate. I'm more worried about other herbicides. Unfortunately, in my list of characteristics of small farmers, not being linked to good knowledge and information systems and having generally lower education than larger farmers, all this has to do with knowledge intensive things like herbicides, and so it is worrying. What we're hoping to do, and I guess it's following more on the South Asian model, what we would like to do is develop service providers, people in the community who we can train properly to be able to use herbicides and actually do those herbicide applications. Because the possibility of training all of the farmers with all of the knowledge to be able to use them and not get into problems, I think is, as you say, very difficult.
Large farmers have enough problems.
Yeah, right.
How many years does it take for the practice to be established so that the benefits are obvious to farmers? Especially, I'm thinking small farmers that startup costs are something that are very difficult for them to
People like us working with conservation agriculture, we always hope that, this is very, I hate to say this, but we always hope that the first year is going to be a dry year. Because if it is, the farmers see the benefit immediately and they will take it up. So in the worse the conditions, the drier the situation, farmers see the benefits very quickly. Under the better situations, it takes more time.